What is, I mean, because I think it's instructive for other groups that he, it feels like he's maligned women. I mean, he started in 16 bragging about grabbing women between the legs and then doubled down in a deposition and said, you've been able to do that for a million years. But there, it feels like there's a numbness. Why aren't Puerto Ricans numb?
Because we have that spirit and we have that pride. You could knock us down 100 times and we will get back tenfold. We will get back up each and every time. You know, the thing that was shocking to me was how Trump didn't get ahead of this. He could have had a John McCain moment, but then again, he's no John McCain, right?
Right.
Remember when that person was in the audience and was throwing disparaging comments to Obama about Obama? And John McCain went over to that woman and said, took the mic and said, no, 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 no. He's a good man. We think differently, but he's a good man.
Loves his country.
He loves his country. Mm-hmm. That could have been Trump. That could have been Trump. And he would have just, but it's not in him. And that's the point. That's the point. We are looking at character here. And how are we going to vote for someone like that who talks about us like that, who allows negative comments to just go on like that? He has yet to apologize.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps saying, I didn't think it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then trying to jump on Joe Biden's mistake. And it was a mistake. At least Joe Biden had got in front of it. You know,
and Harris has distanced herself from it.
Yeah, and exactly. But, you know, all the times he's called people that don't agree with him scum, garbage, degenerates, the list can go on and on and on. The nerve that he has right now. And he's only doing it because he's desperate, because he knows he messed up.
Victor, what are you hearing from your callers? You've been so great about giving us real-time inputs.
Well, I'm going to pick up where Rosie was telling you about Austin being proud. I know you want to talk to me because I'm from Pennsylvania, but I'm here to give you a little bit of news. The reason why I'm talking to you from inside of a car right now, it's because I'm in Orlando, Florida. You know why I'm in Orlando, Florida? I'm in Orlando, Florida, where 500,000 Puerto Ricans live because the Puerto Rican community and the Puerto Rican leaders in the community are making a move. They're trying to unify the Puerto Rican community, the 500,000 Puerto Ricans in the Central Florida area, and the 1+ million Puerto Ricans in Florida, to try to get them together, energize them, and get them out to vote in Florida on November 5th.
I mean, this is so instructive in terms of the mental shift you need to win elections. I mean, just give me more of where that comes from, and this idea that we have the power. I feel like some of what Trump benefits from over and over again is the disempowerment that group. Well, he's just going to do what he's going to do. His base isn't going to care. It feels like what you're both saying is that even people that thought they were aligned with him are reconsidering, and not just reconsidering, but trying to change the outcome of the result, even in Florida?
Well, you have to look at the history of Puerto Rico. Oh, I'm sorry, Victor.
It's funny because I know what you're going to say, and I was going to say the same thing. If you look at the history of Puerto Rico, Puerto Ricans have gone through so much adversity through our history that it's in us. It's in our blood. Like Rosie say, we get knocked down, but we get up again. And again, I've said it in other interviews, there is two things that you don't mess with when it comes to Puerto Ricans, and that's the island and the flag. Those things are sacred to us. We don't mess around. You can play with us. You can make fun of us. You can make fun of our accents. We'll have fun with you. But going after our island, going after our flag, it's like going after our mother. You know, those are things you don't mess with. You just don't mess with those things. And when we spoke the other day, I mentioned this to you. He brought everything from what happened with Maria back.
Yeah.
Right. That wound was healing. We were mad at him when it happened years ago, but then all of a sudden that wound got scratched and now it's bleeding again. And so, this time around, so close to the election, Puerto Ricans are just getting up. I mean, we were talking about what my audience is saying in Pennsylvania, and exactly what Rosie was saying. What's getting people madder and madder by the hours is the fact that now Trump has had multiple times to get in front of a camera and say, listen, my campaign doesn't agree with those things. That's not what I believe. But over and over and over again, I mean, while sitting in a garbage truck, they ask him the question about Puerto Rico. And listen, I don't know the comedian, not a big deal. And so that just makes people even madder. Like, okay, so day one, day two, day three, it's not a big deal. I was a love fest. I was proud to be part of the event. So that just keeps rubbing the wound, and then the blood keeps coming out, and our hearts get even darker. And so, again, look where I'm at. I'm in Orlando, Florida, because they're trying to rally the Puerto Rican community in Orlando, Florida. Again, 500,000 Puerto Ricans just in the Central Florida area, to see if they can mobilize them and get them out to vote.
I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody. I may be in jail, but I am somebody. I may be uneducated, but I am somebody. I am black, beautiful, proud. I must be respected. I must be protected.
Flag is drenched with our blood, because you see, so many of our ancestors was killed because we have never accepted slavery. We had to live on it, but we've never wanted it. So we know that this flag is drenched with our blood. So what the young people are saying now, give us a chance to be young men respected as a man. As we know, this country was built on the black backs of black people across this country. And if we don't have it, you ain't gonna have it either, because we gonna tear it up. That's what they saying. And people ought to understand that. I don't see why they don't understand that. They know what they've done to us. All across this country, they know what they've done to us.
solidarity.
There comes a time when we heed a sudden call, when the world must come together as one. Change. We are all a part, just great people.
hurt me.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
There was a young man organizing the march named Bayard Rustin. Mm-hmm. And when Bayard called people, no, you did. There was no, you couldn't say no. Bayard was, first he was Dr. King's lieutenant, but he had the capacity to organize hundreds of thousands of people. And he, when he has a plan and a program, you know, he calls you and he tells you how the whole thing depends on you. If you don't show up, you don't do what you're supposed to, the whole thing is going to collapse and it's going to be blamed on you. Bayard reached out to me and to Ruby and just said, we need somebody to MC the first part of the program in the March on Washington while the people are assembling. There needs to be entertainment and we need somebody to sort of keep it going. So Ruby, you and Ossie, you are selected.
The late Ossie Davis. For 7 decades, Davis led a distinguished career as an actor, writer, director, and producer. Along with his beloved wife, Ruby Dee, he was a renowned civil rights activist and an unforgettable figure in the African-American struggle for equality. In 1946, he began his acting career in Harlem. He made his film debut in 1950 in the Sidney Poitier film, No Way Out. Davis experienced many of the same struggles that most African-American actors of his generation underwent. He wanted to act but did not want to play stereotypical subservient roles such as butler that were the standard for African-American actors of his generation. Instead, he tried to follow the example of Poitier and played more distinguished characters. When he found it necessary to play a Pullman porter or a butler, he tried to inject the role with a certain degree of dignity. In 1998, Davis and Ruby Dee published their dual autobiography, In This Life Together, in celebration of their 50th wedding anniversary. On February 4th, 2005, Davis was found dead in Miami, where he was making a movie. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Ossie and Ruby, In This Life Together, In Black America.
In the Hollywood entertainment industry syndrome, professional or an actor is looked on as a celebrity, as a commodity, and is taught to teach the public to worship himself or herself as an object of divine whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you begin to consider only yourself, if yourself is your only object, then all other things will begin to fall away from you. You have to learn in this business that yourself cannot be your only object. You have to say, myself and my wife and my children, those are the things that mean the most to me, and I don't care what fame does or celebrity does. That's where I will be going, and that's where I stake my claim. You have to be tough and say, I'm going to make this marriage work, because if I lose this one, the only thing I can do is get another, which will be just like it, so I might as well make this one work.
Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee were one of the most revered couples of the American stage, two of the most prolific and fearless artists in American culture. As individual and as a team, they created profound and lasting work that has touched all of us. With courage and tenacity, they often broke new ground for African Americans and opened many a door previously shut tight to African American artists. This generation may recognize Davis and Dee for their appearances in several Spike Lee movies, including Malcolm X, in which Davis played himself, having delivered the eulogy for the slain civil rights leader. Born on December 18, 1917, in Cogsdale, Georgia, the oldest of five children, Davis grew up in Waycross, Georgia. On December 9, 1948, Davis and Ruby Dee were married. In 1950, they made their film debut in No Way Out with Sidney Poitier and then starred together on Broadway in A Raisin in the Sun. In honoring this legendary couple and celebrating the birthday of Davis, In Black America presents this rebroadcast of a 1998 interview regarding the publication of their dual autobiography.
I finally persuaded Ossie to write this book, and after 50 years later, you know, mm-hmm. and So we finished that. William Morrow is publishing it. It chronicles our lives from before we... I mean, it's about our lives from before we met each other to when we met, and all through our time up until now.
One seems to forget that all of us are human beings under our stardom or whatever our vocation. Was it difficult in going back and reliving those early years?
Not difficult in an emotional sense.
Sometimes it was that too.
It was that. But what was difficult was that we found that we had different memories often of the same thing.
Okay.
And sometimes we couldn't reconcile our differences. So I wrote my version. Ruby wrote her version. May the best contestant emerge triumphant.
And then sometimes it's conversation, sometimes it's, dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then we take chapters. The format kind of varies, like that.
Like life does.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take you all to put this work together?
2 solid years.
But Ossie wasn't solid because in between that we were working. One of us would be away, and thank God Ossie's the writer in the family. So he kind of kept us on track, and we were working with a wonderful woman, Sydney Mahone, whom I know as a dramaturg. And others were helping us with research. So that was, we had, and our children sometimes, especially my daughter Nora, helping us with the memories when they were small. And so it was, so that helped a great deal. But I just had to quarrel a little bit with that word solid. And also those times when we had some disagreements too about this and that.
But we never came to blows.
No, we never came to blows. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Davis, are you still your own editor and censor?
I am still my own editor and censor, but I found out that a lot of people have gotten into the act. So it's me and a whole board of directors telling me what to do.
Tell our audience how you all met in 1948.
Well, now, let's talk
your
about
version.
That a minute here.
Your version.
Yes.
We were both involved in a play called Jib.
Mm-hmm.
And we met at the New Amsterdam Theater on 42nd Street in New York.
Yes. Is that where the Lion King is now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That first day at rehearsal. And it didn't seem extraordinary to me at all. And
I came on board as an understudy, see?
Yeah.
And I had seen his picture in the paper, but I hadn't met him. But I didn't even like his picture because I had wondered some other people I knew from the American Negro Theater, that's the community theater where I got into the business. I wanted one of those guys to get the lead. So I was really very disappointed. And then when I saw him, it was even worse because I thought he looked so peculiar. I was just, and his understudy and I used to sit in the auditorium and kind of talk about him,
mm-hmm.
because he was this tall, skinny guy that looked like with this big Adam's apple that went up and down when he talked, and he kind of like spilled along out of his, and hung out of his clothes. The clothes were too, it's like this tall, skinny guy wearing the clothes of this short, fat man. he just looked strictly from poverty, but he didn't seem to be self-conscious about it or anything.
I had my mojo going.
But we agreed that he was a good actor,
And that's how it all got started.
You all have been very involved with the activism of this country. How has that paralleled you all's acting careers?
Well, first let me say that we have been involved in activism in our country, but remember, activism has been involved with us.
I understand.
We were born black, and when we married in 1948, being black was not a happy state of affairs in this country. There were many places where people couldn't vote. People were still getting lynched. Soldiers returning from the war were being killed if they lined up to vote. So when we came into the theater, we were already in the midst of the struggle of our people for dignity and work and freedom. We had no option. There was no way of get out of being black, Mm-hmm. So you had to get buckle down and struggle.
And also our parents, I think about my mother walking picket lines on 125th Street. We went with her picketing for jobs in the stores where we couldn't work, but we could only go there and buy. We couldn't own stores on 125th Street. You know, I remember that kind of activity since I remember, and the poverty and the people being put out in the street. So we were kind of born, both of us, from different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. And I remember on two occasions when my father's life was threatened by the Ku Klux Klan. And on one occasion, we stayed up all night waiting for the Klan to come. They didn't come, but we got the message, you know. So struggle was always a part of who I was and a part of who Ruby was.
And also it was part of the marriage, too, because the times that we live in affect you in personal ways, too. I preceded Women's Lib, and as I look back, that affected me a lot because I had no ways of thinking about what I felt was ailing me, what I felt was wrong with my being married and all that thing. You know, once I got used to it, and I said, oh, this thing is unfair. This is it's lopsided, you know, when it comes to the involvement of women and men. And so the whole thing struck me after we got married. So through my, as I began this quest, this scratching, this search, and honestly, being a sensitive person, thank God, we managed to scratch our way and move our way into another level of understanding as human beings. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. But part of it, I think, Ruby, was because we knew how to struggle even with each other. We knew how to fight with each other. Yeah. We knew how to try and arrive at some common truth that would embrace us both. And we had some marvelous examples when we came into the business. Paul Ropes and Canada Lee. Beautiful young lady named Lena Horne out in Hollywood fighting, you know. So there were examples all along the way that led us into the struggle. And we found that the struggle was our mother, and it kept us so busy that we never had time to stop and ask ourselves if we were happy. Yeah. You know, we didn't have time for that. There was too many.
The involvements were more important than any kind of like disagreements. That's how it seemed to work out. We had so much to do where there was some common thing happening.
Yeah.
We didn't have too long to spend on our personal things. Although we did, we managed to have a few long pouts, you know, going.
Oh, yeah. We had a full personal life. But, you know, if you sit in front of the television in 1963 and you look at what's happening in Birmingham and the dogs snapping at children, the water hose knocking people off their feet, you don't look at your wife and say, I wonder if I'm happy. You get mad as hell. You want to do something about it. You know, so the struggle catches you up in it. It's a part of who you are, and it certainly helped to keep us together and define who we were and what we had to do in this life. Struggle is the center of existence as far as we're concerned, and we intend to keep struggling until we die.
How did you all happen to become the MC of the March on Washington in August 63?
There was a young man organizing the march named Bayard Rustin.
Mm-hmm.
And when Bayard called people, you couldn't say no. Bayard was, first he was Dr. King's lieutenant, but he had the capacity to organize hundreds of thousands of people. And when he has a plan and a program, you know, he calls you and he tells you how the whole thing depends on you. If you don't show up, if you don't do what you're supposed to do, the whole thing is going to collapse and it's going to be blamed on you. Bayard reached out to me and to Ruby and just said, we need somebody to MC the first part of the program in the March on Washington while the people are assembling.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be entertainment, and we need somebody to sort of keep it going. So, Ruby, you and Ossie, you are selected.
What was the feeling once you heard the I Have a Dream speech at the march?
Well, it was, remember, it was, well, 250,000 people there, and it had been a most exciting day. And believe it or not, there had been some other very exciting speeches, but that certainly was the one that topped them all. And we found ourselves, after the speech, just sort of hugging each other, crying, laughing, and just feeling an explosion of joy in the bottom of our belly. because Martin and Speak, when he said, I have a dream, we knew he meant we have a dream. Mm-hmm. And we knew that we had arrived.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Now on with our conversation.
What has been the secret of these 50 years? If we could bottle it, we could sell it.
That's true. Tell them, Ruby, because I don't know.
I tell you the truth. I when people first used to ask us that, especially young people in our travels, we kind of would give a flip answer, you know, is it, well, we have managed to kill each other. Well, just do one day at a time. Well, just don't go to bed mad. We prefer about things like that. Mm-hmm. We did for a long time, but it occurred to us that they were asking serious questions. This relationship business is not easy.
Right.
You know, how to be together, man, woman, wife, sexual partner, temptation, jealousy, envy, resentment, you know, all these things creep into our lives to one degree or another, you know, and if you're lucky in marriage, we finally concluded, is a process. It's not something that you do. The wedding is something you do in a day, but marriage is something you do for the rest of your life every day, you know, around some issues, and I just feel it's kind of a percentage game. If there are more things around which you can agree and can enjoy life, then those things are for which you want a divorce, then that marriage feels like it's successful. The same thing with love. I thought I was in love when I first got married, but it wasn't many years into the thing when I realized that I was feeling some things that didn't belong with love, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were going through some things that I questioned a lot of times, and many times when we have an argument, Ossie, we wake up the next morning and Ossie would say, well, do you wish you'd married so-and-so? You know, some question like that, and I get angry at the question. Or he would say, well, if you're going to quit me, I'm going to go with you. So what, one thing that saved us in the rough times was a sense of humor, I tell you the truth. Because we found something to laugh about, you know, the ridiculousness of what the things that were upsetting us, especially after they'd passed. and I used to get angry with him because I didn't think he was a good fighter. I didn't think he knew how to argue very well. And I think there's something about being able to argue constructively and creatively, that sometimes it clears the air and gets some understanding, because then sometimes we'd have a fight and the next morning Ossie would tell me that he understood something. And eventually he began to feel with me about how I was feeling as a woman. And being a very smart guy, he would read up on the subject, he thought about things, and he began to reevaluate women. Me, his mother, women in general, this whole woman as object question, the woman as intellect, mind, me as a person capable of being of use in his work, and useful to him as a sounding board. I'm a good collaborator, but I had to kind of fight my way into his consciousness. I had to move beyond just being a woman. This marriage business is not easy, but we're hoping that this book will give young marrieds some idea, you know, because we, for instance, study everything in school but relationships.
Right.
The most important thing, there's no compulsory course on marriage or child rearing or anything like that that affects us. You have to learn by trial and error. And if you're lucky, you hang together through the rough times and not think that every challenge is an end.
Yeah, and marriage is really what you make it. You have to make what it is you want. Now, in the Hollywood entertainment industry syndrome, a professional or an actor is looked on as a celebrity, as a commodity, and is taught to teach the public to worship himself or herself as an object of divine whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you begin to consider only yourself, if yourself is your only object, then all other things will begin to fall away from you. You have to learn in this business that yourself cannot be your only object. You have to say, myself and my wife and my children, those are the things that mean the most to me. And I don't care what fame does or celebrity does. That's where I will be going, and that's where I stake my claim. You have to be tough and say, I'm going to make this marriage work, because if I lose this one, the only thing I can do is get another, which will be just like it. So I might as well make this one work.
You all were with Malcolm X a day or 2 days before his untimely assassination. Give us a little insight into the man.
Well, I think the last time we saw him, which you say was not too long before, he left us. He did come to our house by himself, and just Ruby and me and Malcolm sat, and we just listened and let him talk. Mm-hmm. And what was very apparent was that this dedicated, very brilliant, very strong character, very spiritual man, had one thing that hurt him more than anything else, and that was his estrangement from his father figure, Elijah Muhammad. Mm-hmm. He never really got over that. And so all of the things that we admired him for, we knew about and the public knew about. But when he sat to talk, and he talked and talked, we could see a young man, a boy, reaching out for a father who was no longer there. And that's the inner central core of my memories of Malcolm.
Ms. D?
I don't know. I thought too of what racism does to us. We're all affected by it, and I think particularly black men, and particularly and women too in other areas, like women. But this that his struggle against being relegated to niggerdom, mm-hmm. as Ossie talks about in the book, this thing that unfortunately happens in our culture it seems to be like a constant problem, is how do we reach through racism and love each other. And then Malcolm was that attempt for the manhood that Ossie wrote about, that reach toward that for all of us. You saw it all. He carried with him all the time, and yet he had a beautiful vulnerability and a nice sense of humor with that crooked little smile, you know. Mm-hmm. And but I think he was thrust in a direction that was that was more than just himself. He was a person sitting. I met him through my brother Edward, but he transformed my brother, and their families were very close. And then, but he was a man who was a public. He was a personification of black men in struggle, mm-hmm. and so he couldn't have. His personal life was second. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, these people who walk the earth, they come here for more than themselves. They come here to live for a lot of people, just to be part of their aspiration and the thrust. Yes.
Is there a greater appreciation? I'm quite sure you love both venues, stage and film.
Well, I personally prefer the stage because I am a writer, and I find that writing for the stage means that you write a work that will exist on its own terms as long as printing exists.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the work that you do on film will not necessarily exist. Nobody goes and reads a film script,
mm-hmm.
and unless somebody takes care to preserve the film, it could very well disappear. So for me, since I'm a writer, stage is my first love.
Well, I can't say that I have a definite preference. I like them both for different reasons. I think there's nothing like a stage for hitting the walls of yourself, you know, finding out what you're all about, trotting the tracks, opening the pathways, and you do it over and over every night on stage. So there's a chance for growth and self examination and use of yourself over and over and over that makes it easier to get to from one point to another. This practice is like going through the path in an uncleared forest. The more you tread it, the smoother and more definite it gets. That's what I think the theater does. It explores the bigness of you and the wideness and the deepness of you, of yourself, that helps you to become a better actor on film, where you're looking, where the camera seems to photograph thoughts and emotions and ideas, and you know the subtleties where the camera can get there greater, I think, than on stage. But I think you grow more on stage than you do in film. Although there are film actors who master that technique and are just as efficient there as. But I mean, to span them both, mm-hmm. I think a stage work is a necessary part of the training process, you know.
Have you all adopted Spike Lee?
Uh-huh. Not officially, but we're working on it.
He's adopted us, I think.
How did
I know,
you?
I know, yeah. Me. I know. I have. I feel. I think with Spike kind of brought me into the attention of a new generation or something, you know, and also through our son, who I think Spike taught a lot of people in the business. He had something about integrity, and I like the way he did the film. The Delta Sigma Theta did it first, but he made a film by the bootstrap, you know. He just did it, and that's what the Deltas did with that film we made, Count Al Cusini. And he gave credit to all the people who helped him, and he took $5 and $500 and $1,000. And my son happened to be one of the investors. So I love Spike for that. He brought people into the union where it was the union. You know, was not known for being. It's kind of, it has a lot to do in terms of racism, and Spike did worked on that front too. Everybody worked for Spike, you know, men, women, black, white, Asians, the physically challenged, all those. I mean, Spike is a conscientious young man, growing philosophically, and so I mean, he's the most exciting person in that realm that I've known. You know,
you all have worked in virtually all the media, radio, television, film, stage. Any new projects on the horizon?
Well, Ruby has a couple of films in the can.
Yeah.
Passing Game?
The Passing Glory, yes, and where Quincy Jones was one of the producers, and David Salzman and Mike Magic Johnson. And it's a basketball film with Andrew Brower.
And the next one is The Baby Geniuses.
No, that one is before then, really, The Baby Geniuses, that's coming out with Dom DeLuise. That was fun for me because I love doing those kind of
okay, could I get one in there?
Yes,
lady?
Uh-huh.
All right, and I did one with Della Reese called The Secret Path, which has yet to show up. Meanwhile, we have other projects that we're busy working on.
The late Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
from KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Now, of course, I wasn't satisfied with the response I got, but I expected that response. This is a racist, sexist country. And I'm a twofer. I'm not only a female, but I'm black. But I did it because I felt that in a multifaceted, variegated nation like this one, why should only white males be the president of the United States of America? I did it because I felt it was necessary to begin to get people thinking about someday, somewhere, somehow, a black person or a woman could be the president of this country. I knew they would laugh at me and they would giggle, because anytime anybody goes against a tradition, they tend to think of you as an oddball. But the catalyst for change in a society are always the person that has to take the insults and the misinterpretations to break the barriers down in the society. So I'm a very strong person, and I did it, and I don't regret it one bit. But I didn't expect to win. I really didn't expect to win, but I knew that I would be able to break away some of that feeling that only a certain segment of society should only be the group in our society to feel that they can be the head of the ship of state.
The late Shirley A. Chisholm, former Congresswoman, New York's 12th Congressional District. In 1968, Chisholm became the first African-American woman elected to Congress. She went on to represent Brooklyn for seven terms, from 1969 to 1983. In 1972, she became the first major party African-American candidate for president of the United States and the first woman to run for the Democratic presidential nomination. Throughout her career in Congress, Chisholm worked to improve opportunities for inner-city residents. She was a vocal opponent of the draft and supported spending increases for education, health care, and other social services, and reduction in military spending. She was a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus, a fierce advocate for women's rights and democracy, and a staunch opponent of the Vietnam War. Chisholm died on January 1, 2005, at the age of 80. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to Shirley A. Chisholm, In Black America.
Well, when I first went to the United States House of Representatives, it was a little bit difficult because they'd never had to deal with a black who is female in the House of Representatives. I was the first one to be elected to that position. I think the most difficult thing at that point, however, was the fact that they couldn't seem to understand how I was so terribly articulate and not afraid of anything or anybody. Because I guess in terms of the traditional historical patterns of how they perceive black women, you're supposed to be more or less subservient and almost bow when you see them in the chamber. It was very difficult for them to understand that I just was not of that ilk. But I'd like to say that within 3 or 4 months, actually, when they realized that I had potential, I had ability, and that I was very serious about what I was doing, that their attitudes change, and I've never had any problems, you know, since that time.
Chisholm's leadership traits was recognized by her parents early on. She was the first African-American woman elected to Congress. She was a passionate and effective advocate for the needs of minorities, women, and children, and has changed the nation's perception of the capabilities of women and African-Americans. Born Shirley Anita St. Hill in New York City on November 30, 1924, she was the oldest of four daughters of Caribbean immigrants. In 1927, she and her sisters were sent to live with their maternal grandparents in Barbados. In 1934, she rejoined her parents in New York City. In 1942, she graduated from Girls High School with honors. Chisholm attended Brooklyn College and majored in sociology. She graduated with honors from Brooklyn College in 1946. She began a professional career at Mount Calvary Child Care Center in Harlem, eventually becoming director of a daycare center and later served as an education consultant for the city's child care department. She became active in local Democratic politics and ran successfully for the state assembly in 1964. She served for 4 years. In 1968, she ran for the United States Congress. She was elected from the newly created 12th District of New York City. She became the first African-American woman elected to Congress. In February 1982, In Black America spoke with the late Shirley A. Chisholm.
The issue facing black Americans in the 80s are the same issues that have consistently and persistently confronted us. The issues of employment. The fantastic escalation of the unemployment statistics in the black communities across this nation is almost incomprehensible. I've been traveling quite a bit, and in many of these communities, the statistics are as high as 40% of the employable black adults not working. This is a devastation of human potential in its worst form. And of course, once a man has a job, once a man has employment, it is very easy then for him to do the additional things in society that are necessary. He can get the kind of housing that he needs because he has the money to pay for the kind of housing. He's able to put aside money for potential educational training of his sons and his daughters. Employment continues to be the number one issue in the black community.
You mentioned today in your address a new women's movement. Could you expound on that further?
We are about the business of realizing that we have to harness the power of women in this country, because it becomes increasingly important at this point in time to recognize that if we are going to bring about the kinds of changes in our society that deals with the human being, that deals with the potential of every child, whether it's a male child or female child, or whether it's a black person or a white person, that the female who has the compassion, more tolerance, I think, and more understanding, will have to become much more involved in the political arena. And so as I leave the United States House of Representatives, I'm not sitting down. I'm about some other business in this country.
Chisholm represented the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, New York, serving until she retired in 1983. Also, she was a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus. During her first term in Congress, she hired an all-female staff and spoke out for civil rights, women's rights, the poor, and against the Vietnam War. Newly elected, she was assigned to the House Agriculture Committee, which she felt was irrelevant to her urban constituency. In an unheard-of move, she demanded reassignment and was switched to the Veteran Affairs Committee. Not long after, she voted for Hal Boggs, who was white, over John Conyers, who was black, for majority leader. Boggs rewarded her with a place on the Education and Labor Committee, and she was his third-ranking member when she retired.
Well, when I first went to the United States House of Representatives, it was a little bit difficult because they'd never had to deal with a black who is female in the House of Representatives. I was the first one to be elected to that position. I think the most difficult thing at that point, however, was the fact that they couldn't seem to understand how I was so terribly articulate and not afraid of anything or anybody. Because I guess in terms of the traditional historical patterns of how they perceive black women, you're supposed to be more or less subservient and almost bow when you see them in the chamber. It was very difficult for them to understand that I just was not of that ilk. But I'd like to say that within 3 or 4 months, actually, when they realized that I had potential, I had ability, and that I was very serious about what I was doing, that their attitudes changed, and I've never had any problems, you know, since that time. The main reason for my leaving the United States Congress is I indicated in that long press release that was sent out was that I desired to return to a more private life where I would have more flexibility of my time. That I had been out here for 23 years and I had not really enjoyed it.